Hi, guys. Thank you for your continued support of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I also wanted to take a moment and thank two of our wonderful podcast sponsors. The first is Thrive Market. Thrive is a new online marketplace offering the world's best-selling natural and organic products at wholesale prices. If Costco and Whole Foods Online got together at a rave and got liquored up, their child would look a lot like Thrive Market. So the way that Thrive works, for less than $5 a month, about $59.95 annually, you get a membership that gives you access to more than 2,500 of the highest quality food, supplement, home, personal care, and beauty products. Those are all delivered straight to your door and at 25 to 50% below retail price. Orders above $49 are free, but that's only in the continental United States. RobWolf.com followers get a free two-month Thrive Market membership, as well as 20% off of your first order. So go to thrivemarket.com/RobWolf, and you can get in on that deal. Our second podcast sponsor is Hylete. Check out Hylete's innovative athletic apparel at Hylete.com. If you love Hylete, and I absolutely do, you can love a whole lot more of them, because if you enter the code ROBWOLF50, ROBBWOLF50, you receive a holy cats worthy 50% off your purchase. Thank you again, and it's time for the show. Hi, folks. Rob Wolf here, another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Very excited today. We have one of our all-time most beloved guests. She is the author of the phenomenal book, Move Your DNA, Katie Bowman, biomechanist, farmer, mom, and changer of the world, and expert mover. Katie, how are you doing?
I'm good. Farmer, that's the first time it's ever been in my bio before.
Well, I recently added that to my bio too, so...
And relative to the amount of work, it really should be first. Right. Like, I feel like farmer, mother, biomechanist is probably more the appropriate order there.
Right. Awesome. So we were just talking about your... Now, remind me, how old are your kids again?
2.5 and just 4.
2.5 and 4. Okay. So we have a 3-year-old and a 11-month-old. So we're kind of in the same.
Yeah.
Same deal. Awesome. So what is new? You've been on the road a lot, I've noticed.
Yeah, Europe. That was on the cobblestones, so the cobblestone roads a lot, and took a little bit of a vacation to Iceland in between doing some work in Europe. And then trying to get back last year, I made the big mistake of traveling, leaving where I live, which is the most gorgeous in the summertime, and doing like a big Move Your DNA book tour during the summer. And I was like, we'll never do that again. Let's do it during the winter when it's, you know, where we want to leave. And so we timed it so that this last big kind of hurrah for the summer ended May 31st. So now I'm home and I don't have to go anywhere for a few months, and I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. What did you think of Iceland? I've always been intrigued, have never been there.
Oh, it's amazing. It's such a primal place, because it is in the process of forming, that it's very much like being a flea on the back of a dog. You know, like, it's like it's busy doing what it's doing, and you're just hoping that a big giant leg doesn't come and scratch you off while you're there. So it's mostly lava, and nothing grows there. You know, so the Icelandic diet, I bought this great little book about, it's just this cute little tiny book, and I learned so much about Iceland. I gleaned so much about what they eat. So they're like, their basic diet is fermented meats and skyr, which is like a kind of a low fat yogurt, and seaweed. You know, they didn't have salt. They didn't have grains. It used to be forested, like, you know, the bulk of the planet, but it was rapidly deforested when people first got there because of heat. You know, they used all of the wood. And then, so I think grains grew there once upon a time, but then once the wood was gone, then the whole system changed. And then it was just mostly meat and seaweed. They used the seaweed for a lot of their vitamins and fish. You know, they started fishing and dehydrated fish, and it's a very limited. We had a traditional breakfast of dehydrated fish and coffee with seaweed in it.
Wow.
And that's it. Like, there's no fruits or vegetables. So it's very interesting. That plus, then, you know, like volcanoes and we hiked hot springs, and we hiked up on a volcano to where the ice, the snowpack, was turning into a river. The drink, everything's drinkable there. All the water is drinkable. Hmm. And I was like, wow, you know, with our little kids, we're like, this is insane right now. We're on a volcano watching snow turn into this drinking supply. Like, this is it. Your school's done for the year, kids. Right. Like, you don't need, like, there's nothing else you need to do.
Hydrocycle is done. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was cool.
That is cool. You know, I was listening to kind of a politics econ podcast recently, and they had a Icelandic economist and banking guy on there. And it was really interesting. In the Icelandic language, the term for windfall, you know, like if you're playing Monopoly and it's like, you have a windfall of $200 or whatever. But the analogous term in Icelandic is whale washes up on the beach.
Right. Because food. Because, yeah, I mean, like, big, that's food. The mother load right there.
Right, right.
Mother load.
Yeah, so that was so fascinating. Well, I saw that you guys were in Iceland, and that's some place that I've wanted to check out. So maybe we'll give that a shot sometime soon.
Well, and a plug for Iceland Air. You know, Iceland Air is this airline that started up, I think, just to improve their tourism. And you can go to Europe via Iceland, and you can get off and stay in Iceland for 4 days at no charge.
Really?
Yeah. So like, that's what we do. It's like, we just use Iceland as a way to break up. From Seattle to Iceland's only 7 hours. So it's an evening flight. We get on at 4:00. Kids are asleep by 6:30. We watch a couple movies. We land at, you know, 11:30 our time. It's like, it's not a strenuous hump at all. You just get over there, take a few days. And, you know, there's the big tourism geothermal pool, but the movement is not easy to come by there because of the extreme cold weather. So the government has taken a lot of their water, their hot springs water, and made swimming pools, warm swimming pools all over the country. And it's like, they're like $6 or $8, you know, to go in, and you can stay for hours, and they're like water parks. They have water slides with warm water. And so everyone's just swimming year round. And so we went swimming for hours every day because you're warm, you know, from the neck down, you just dunk your head under. And it was really awesome. It was just total, it's just very different, you know, than anything you've experienced or anything I've experienced.
Wow. Very cool. It seems like going in the summer would be kind of cool because you get some long days, maybe some aurora borealis and all that stuff. So, oh, super cool.
Yeah.
Well, today we have something a little different. We have a Q&A session because I had thrown out the possibility of doing a book club because Move Your DNA was just one of the most powerful, transformative books that I've read in probably the last 10 years. And as good an idea as that was in theory, it was horrific given both my schedule and your schedule. So in lieu of that, we kicked around the idea of doing some Q&A from some folks. And so do you want to jump in on some questions?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so the first one, the title is Best Footwear for Hard Surfaces. Arthur says, I just heard Ben Greenfield mentioning on another podcast a standing mat called Keybounder, which was developed to strengthen the foot muscles. The same company also sells shoes, and they provide proper cushioning while our feet can feel the surface. Any thoughts on that product or alternatives?
Well, I guess I'll put on my Move Your DNA hat. So, you know, what we're going for now in terms of like rethinking movement is how many different movement nutrients can I gather throughout the day? So flat and level, you know, if I'm thinking about people, who's going to want a standing mat? People who are going from sitting, maybe traditional workstations, to standing workstations, standing all day on something hard kind of sucks for your feet. So there are these mats, and there's a bunch of different mats coming out, and they're called anti-fatigue mats. This one, I don't know if it is a Keybounder, Keybounder. I don't know. KY Bounder. You know, if you guys want to look it up, it's just like a dense foam mat. So when you step on it, you kind of sink into it, and they use it in PT or, you know, corrective exercise facilities where you're trying to create a little bit of instability. So when you step on it, it's very malleable, deforms. And if you are moving on it, you know, if you're stepping, then you would, it would massage or work your feet. So I would say that that's one type of surface. You kind of sink into it. So it's kind of like standing in mud, right? You get into mud and you just sink down. That was a sound effect that I just made right there. I do that a lot. But then I'm thinking about in terms of alternatives, an alternative wouldn't necessarily be in lieu of, it could be like, I like the new topo mat. So the topo mat, which are not shipping yet, they are these mats that have a contour to them. So as you're standing there or working, you could position your feet differently so that they're slightly uphill or slightly downhill, or you can have one foot uphill and the other foot pointing downhill. It's, you can go look at them online. They have mounds on them. So in that way, you're introducing different variables than the Kai mat. The Kai mat is like squishy and malleable. The topo mat's a little bit more firm, but it would duplicate maybe the loads of standing on or walking over, depending on how much movement you're doing at your desk, over varied terrain with different pitches in it. So I just, in the end, I don't know if the goal is to find the perfect product or that if any one product is going to replace the movement, but you could certainly cycle through maybe two or three different things, even if you're just making them yourself, like folding a yoga mat over four or five times, you know, and just stand and put your heels down on the ground and your toes up on the mat, and then mm-hmm. switches so your heels are up on the mat and the toes down and vice versa. You're just moving around the whole time. Movement is the key. So any product that will allow you to vary your movement would be beneficial, would be my final like thought on the matter, I guess.
I like it. I like that a lot. I have not had a chance to play with those, but I have been folding up the mat, the yoga mat, and putting that. I'm actually standing on a treadmill desk right now, and phone calls, I can use that. If the weather's good, I just go outside and hope that my cell reception is up to snuff. But typing while using a treadmill desk, I'm very, very prone to motion sickness, and I actually mm-hmm. get motion sick typing while walking. I'm such a loser. So I've tried to mix that up. But even to your point, that's a very kind of monostructural type of a movement palette to draw from, like, you know, possibly better than just sitting or just standing, but would lend itself to getting some more variety in that, clearly.
Yeah. And then to always think about, this was like to go back to our original conversation on Vibrams, like the first time I was on your mm-hmm. show. The benefit is not in the tool. The benefit is in how you use it. So if you have a mat and then you just stand still on the mat, there's not really a lot of benefit to your musculoskeletal system. If you're moving yourself over the mat, that's where the benefit comes from. So I think that a lot of times these products are created using the arguments of, you know, see, as you step on it, it does X, but they're only considering like that you stepped on it. Now that benefit was in the first, you know, 2 seconds that you used it. If you just continue to stand there being still, that benefit does not continue to cycle. So movement is the key. And I would say any tool in that way is going to be beneficial. And then a whole variety of tools would be even more beneficial.
So Katie, you're saying that tools, we need to use them effectively and continue to do something. They just don't do everything for us, right?
It's like, I've been sleeping on Move Your DNA under my pillow and it's fantastic. It's great. It's varied up the angle of my neck and whatnot. Yeah, you got to use your tools.
Right, right. Awesome. Okay. Let's see here. Jumping into recurring lumbar herniated discs. Joe says, I have problems with recurring lumbar herniated disc. What movement should I be working on to improve this? Is there a simple answer or does it require an in-person assessment? I have some guesses on that, but we'll go to the expert.
Yeah, it's not a simple answer, right? So it's not a simple answer, or it could be. You know, the simple answer could be that there is a way of moving, a variety of movements, plugging some micronutrients in the form of corrective exercises back into what you're doing. But to be able to give someone a corrective exercise, you know, via a podcast or even via a blog post, or even if I say something like, Joe, you should be doing the spinal twist, you know, because, you know, your herniated discs, and herniated discs is a category. Everything's a category. Herniated discs is a category. Your corrective exercises for your herniated discs is going to differ than someone else's because a herniation isn't always in the same direction. So you're using corrective exercise to reform your structure. And so in that way, it requires an in-person, I don't even know if in-person is the right word. It requires a specific exercise prescription, if you will, for you and your particular movement habits. Because if I listed the exercises, there is a very high chance that the way you would perform the corrective exercises are using the ranges of motion that you use all of the time that led to your injury. So why I like in-person assessments is that it's more of like an in-person personalized teaching lesson for you. And I think that you can get that ability to understand your own structure, not necessarily in person, but before you learn the corrective exercises, I would say the first step is to learn how to better assess how you are moving, meaning you have to be able to put yourself on a grid. And so if I say, okay, you're going to do a spinal twist, but you should also be able to, you know, hang so that your trunk muscles have the ability to stabilize your lower part of the body relative to the upper part of the body, that you first see how you're doing those exercises in your most natural way, which would be a way that would probably exacerbate your injury. And then could you work with parameters that would allow you to perform what would still fit into the same category of those exercises, but in a way that coaxed your hernia back or would change the pressure system so that hernia didn't continue to be there. So it's a complicated answer. I do think that you can learn how to move without feeling like you have to go somewhere to be, you know, to spend a lot of money to travel or whatever, but you could certainly visit your local corrective exercise or physio specialist, someone who really understands movement assessment to see where some of the holes are, and then they can give you some exercises. But if the big question is, are there exercises to fix it? I think that yes, there are. And then also, are you correcting the broader habits that led to it, right? Like, are your lumbar disc herniation is not necessarily about corrective exercises that you didn't do as much as the whole way that you move that led to that set of physics that led to that.
The macronutrient movements that are really causing the big input there.
Yeah, I do break them down into macro and micro. I think of like macro in general, like how much you walked. You know, do you squat? Do you carry things? Do you use your arms? And then also, how much time do you spend sitting in a chair? How much time do you spend on the computer? How much time do you spend indoor? Like big macro concepts where the loads are kind of clumped together. And then from there, though, the micronutrients are, when you do a spinal twist, does your left rib shear up farther than your right so that you end up, you're not actually rotating your spine, you're pushing on your discs in a different way. So that's just for the rest of the show, that's how I refer to those terms.
Nice. Now, how many do you have folks through the Restorative Exercise Institute? Is there a way to track practitioners down through that?
Yeah. You could actually go just to Restorative Exercise and find a practitioner. Click. So yeah, that would be a good way of someone who can help you with that.
Fantastic. Okay. Let's see here. Impact on biomechanics from wearing a backpack. And I would slide in this also kid carrier, although we've yeah. developed, we have three different kid carrier options that we use with Sagan. So let's see here. Eric says, first off, enjoy and learn a lot from your show. Keep up the great work. It would be fantastic if you could discuss the impact on biomechanics and possible negative and positive consequences of moving a lot with a backpack, possibly touch on differences in wearing and not wearing a hip strap to take the load off the shoulders in the context of wearing a low profile zero drop shoes. I find that I end up doing most of my walking with a backpack, but that with the laptop and books on the way to class, carrying equipment on the way to work, carrying home groceries, and on weekends and holidays, hiking with tent and food. The pack might weigh anything from 5 to 20 kilos. Might end up walking it 5 to 15 kilometers a day, sometimes jogging a fair bit if the distance of speed is needed. Thanks, Eric from Denmark.
Holy cow.
Hey, you're international.
Well, I know I'm international, but like I that was a long question. Okay, yes. I think the question is, what does wearing a backpack do?
Right.
Okay.
And then also a sub question, pluses and minuses of using that hip belt to transfer load directly into the hips.
Well, okay. So we've got this. We have like on one hand we have this idea of ergonomics, like that there's a best way to load the body. And so a lot of times questions will stem from that. Like, am I wearing a backpack too much? What about backpack with, you know, hiking boots or a heeled shoe? And what about the strap? Okay. So that perspective is coming from, like, ergonomics is coming from this idea that there's an optimal way to do a single thing over and over and over again. So you're trying to find the optimal way, and to, like, mitigate damage. So if, though, we start a little bit farther back where just doing one thing over and over and over again, no matter how you do it, is the problem, then it makes it difficult to answer that type of question. So I'm still going to answer the question, but just so everyone can kind of keep that in their mind. So backpacks are awesome. Backpacks are a way to carry a heavy load without having to do it in your arms. It's like a hands-free way of doing it. However, what it does is kind of keep the load to the same tissues over and over and over again, where it would be more natural to kind of, you know, shift when your arms are tired. You know, like, I carry my kids when my arms are tired, I just change the way that I carry them. And in this way, I'm in a very organic relationship with whole body
fatigues and
body use, though, too. Whole body use, and it allows me to be very creative and to be very reflexive in the way that I respond to fatigue. So I respond to fatigue in my left arm, I transfer to my right arm, which is also using one side of, using my abdominal core as a whole in one particular way or nutrient. And then when I switch arms, I'm getting a different way of using my core or nutrient. That the symmetry doesn't have to be moment by moment. Sometimes symmetry is a use that can be over a day or over a lifetime, that there's a broader idea of symmetry. And then, so I'll throw my kid on my back and then I don't use my arms and then I put them on my shoulders. But either way, when you don't have a technology, you are much more likely, because you have to, cycle through many different ways. But that being said, backpacks are rad. So one way, so there's using a backpack, a single backpack, affects your body in that it calls on the same limited way of using your body. Using your strap would change that a little bit. So there's nothing wrong with using a strap because it transfers the load to a different part of your body. You can also do what I do sometimes, which is wear my backpack on the front, mm-hmm. just as a way of transferring a different load. Because then eventually you get adaptations, structural adaptations to the way that you always carry the weight, and the adaptations aren't necessarily improvements. They're just mass distributions within your body that make what you have done easier on you, so that it's more likely for you to continue that way of doing it in the future. So as far as, like, I don't know how, what else is he asking? Whether you jog in it or are walking, if it's 5 kilos or 20 kilos, it doesn't really matter. Every single difference is a unique load. So sometimes I carry my backpack just over one shoulder and then I'll put it on the other shoulder. So that would be the best way to use that technology. That would be a way to use a technology and also get what you're after, which is a more uniform cellular distribution of load. Same thing with baby carriers, right? You have three, you're cycling through three different kinds. So it gives you different ways of using your body and also your child, right? So your child, like, that's really what I was more concerned with, is like, it's a cast of sorts, right? All these things are casts where it's an unnatural limitation of your full spectrum of movement. So that goes often hand in hand with the technology, is that there are these invisible and sometimes invisible limitations. So when you're cycling through different baby carriers, or when that same baby carrier is being worn by a different person, those are all different loads to the person in the baby carrier. So if you're going to play with your technology, it's pretty easy. Change its position, you know. With the backpack, you're kind of limited. I guess you could put it on your head sometimes, but it's just that. It's just realizing that there is not a uniform there is no optimal repetitious holy grail, you know, right. Like we're not like searching for that is kind of missing the broader point,
right?
I think, which is use your technology as in as varied ways as possible.
And you know, that's such an interesting concept in this, you know, like if you get into the Matt Ridley rational optimist stuff, like the way that we kind of succeed in the modern world is in specialization. So mm-hmm. you get really, really good at doing these certain things, and then, you know, you get a comparative advantage there, and more of that becomes more technology-based, but even that has movement implications. So ironically, you know, for the development of a comparative advantage in the modern world, you need to specialize, but the specialization typically ends up limiting your movement pool, which has all kinds of potentially deleterious effects on your physical being. So that's some interesting stuff.
Yeah, we're in a weird time where movement is not really required for social achievements, but at the same time, it's still required for biological ones. So that's where we're playing right now. Like, right, I think that's the land that we're kind of dwelling in, which is what exactly are the requirements? And I've in the work that I'm doing right now, I'm really trying to flesh out this idea of a movement nutrient, a mechanical nutrient, because we all grew up in a dietary culture where the idea of dietary nutrients were just part of our fabric, our cultural fabric, right? It's part of your elementary school education. You understand this idea that there are inputs that are necessary that have nothing really to do with the foods that you eat. Like, unfortunately, it's been so separated where there are these vitamins that you need, and they don't really have to come in the context of food. Like, there's foods over here. You need food, but you also need vitamins. Sometimes your nutrients don't line up to your diet, so then you can supplement. But we don't have the same understanding of a mechanical nutrient, meaning I think everyone is on my same page when I say, like, you need certain vitamins or your biological process will fail. But we don't do the same for mechanical nutrients. We have kind of a, like, well, I've just adapted away from needing those because I have this technology. And it's like, I'm not so sure. And it all goes down to semantics and like baseline definitions of just because you have to put a technology nutrient supplement pill into your mouth, that doesn't mean that you've, you know, evolved past needing the nutrient. And so mechanically speaking, if there are these mechanical nutrients that are necessary, how do we get a culture that recognizes that there are some inputs? Because unfortunately, at least at this time, there's no way, there's no easy supplementation of a mechanical nutrient. It's not a chemical compound, right? It's the reaction. That's the mechanotransduction is the biochemical response to a chemical compound, which is really what a nutrient is, right? Not what you put in your mouth, but what happens when you put it into your mouth. Mm-hmm. Same thing with mechanical nutrient. The mechanical input is not the nutrient, it's the biochemical response to the mechanical nutrient. And mechanical nutrients, you know, which is just a term that I'm coining and an idea that I'm working towards, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to put that into a pill, because if it's a squeeze or a squish or compression, like maybe there are machines, like there's already vibration machines, you know, you're working towards trying to stimulate the body to secrete this biochemical process. So in that way, it's going to be really interesting. Of course, I'll probably be dead before
anybody figures it out.
Before it's, hey, yeah, we need my vitamin, you know, textured walking today. Like before that, there's that kind of language going on, but whatever.
Right. Well, I've been calling that job security lately. It's frustrating on the one hand, but I'm like, it's job security.
I don't mind the frustration because if anything, I always got farming.
Right. Exactly.
There's always more to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's shift into squatting. Alice says, I'm incredibly envious of my flat-footed squatting sister-in-law. She is of Chinese heritage, and this position is her preferred resting pose. However, I try to squat for about 15 minutes every day and wonder how long it will take to coax my heels to the floor. Are there extra stretches I can do to minimize the time I spend on the balls of my feet? So thankful for everything you do. Thank you, Katie.
That was nice. Are there extra stretches you can do to minimize the time you spend on the balls of your feet? Well, the first exercise is stop spending any time on the ball of your foot. So if you're just standing there and your weight is on the ball of your foot, put your heel down. That's your first exercise. The second exercise is stop wearing positive heeled shoes, which are also putting you on the ball of your foot. So, you know, you're adapting again to what you do most frequently. So, Achilles tendon or calf shorteners would be anything that plantar flexes the foot or flexes the knee. So how much time do you spend sitting in a bent-kneed position? That, like, reducing that is an exercise towards helping you get your heels on the ground during a squat. So what do we have? Back your hips up. Backing your hips up is another way to help you keep your heels down. Those are loads, if you want to put that, what I'm calling an exercise, into this idea of a load, you need to be doing more frequently than you're not doing it. So corrective exercise, again, is something that we're trying to mitigate the effects of doing something all day one way with doing something for 15 minutes. So it's very difficult to get your heels down in a squat because of the ample time you are spending not doing it. So squatting more frequently, it doesn't have to be for longer duration. Like if you're sitting there for 15 minutes struggling to keep your heels down, your heels aren't coming down in that period of time. It could take, you know, years for your heels to come down, but the amount of time it takes for them to come down depends on how you're living your life all of the other time, movement-wise, how you're moving in your life all of the other time. So reduction in sitting, reduction in positive heeled shoes. And then, of course, there are corrective exercises that help you support yourself in these other positions. Because one of the reasons we don't stand all day long or rest in a squatting position or use the floor is because we really don't have the strength or the endurance to be able to do it. So like anything that you're trying to improve your strength or your endurance for, you do it a little bit at first and then you slowly do more and more because you're changing your mass distribution along the way. So the corrective exercises that would supplement these lifestyle changes that I'm talking about, these movement lifestyle changes, are in whole body barefoot. So I wrote a whole book on transitioning to minimal footwear, which I think, you know, it's got like 20 different specific exercises that will help you over time get your heels down because it helps you shift a mass distribution where you're able to use your body to support yourself instead of furniture and shoes.
Nice, nice. Katie, I don't know if you follow Coach Christopher Summer at all. He's a gymnastics coach, developed the gymnastics bodies training methodology, and they use weighted stretches in a pretty interesting way. And I started incorporating some of that, you know, like a goblet squat where I hold a kettlebell, get down into a front squat position. And could you think about that as kind of like a dose response curve? Like if you're loading those tissues in a kind of super physiological way because we have an external load, that maybe we're going to goose some of that structural adaptation. Like I feel really good doing that. And if I've done jujitsu one day and my hips are kind of creaky and my knees are kind of creaky, I'll do a general warm up and then I'll kind of hang out in a goblet squat, do some weighted lunging, but with the emphasis not on muscular work, but on mobility work, I really get a very nice response off that. And I'm 43 years old, you know, connective tissue fascia is probably turning into, fossilized remains at this point. But I get some mileage out of that. What are your thoughts on doing some kind of super physiological loading that way?
Well, I think that, you know, it's complicated. So I'll start with that. I think that there is a large benefit to doing things heavy. I don't know if heavy, I'm just using the word, I'm thinking of a kettlebell. It's heavier. It's an extra load to push you to help facilitate the load. I would have a question. Have you noticed since doing it, like, are you doing it to keep your heels down closer to the ground? Are you doing it specifically for that? Or are your heels already down? Or are you trying to change your joint range of motion, like a number?
My heels are already down. I feel like my hips are a little bit more the bugger there. Like my Achilles tendon range of movement seems to be pretty good, but it really seems to kind of loosen up my hips, and it allows me to be in a good balance between extension and flexion in my low back. Like, I'm in a really nice, really upright torso position. I can feel my spinal erectors firing. It seems to, you know, I have a tendency for my psoas to kind of kick in versus like abdominal wall kicking in on some movements. And it seems to just kind of make all that stuff right.
Well, I think that with corrective exercise, again, that varied input is the goal. Like, what you're trying to do is you're trying to communicate. This is kind of like a poor way of saying it, but you're trying to give your body information about how you would like it to behave. Your body is always just kind of responding to how you would like it to behave. Its interpretation of how you want it to behave being the inputs that you are selecting for it to respond to, right? It's the environment. Habitat is the big thing with movement. So, you know, you've got these gentle stretches, right? Because it's very easy. I'm the reason I'm hesitating on like the kettlebell for this, someone trying to get their heels down is it's very easy to rupture your Achilles tendon. And so putting on too heavy of a load could damage it, right? You can't really force your body to change. But at the same time, forces are the things that
initiate
or facilitate a change. Yeah. So by forces being something different than force being you just wanted to go full Monty. It's like you are a couch potato, you know, as far as your Achilles tendons are concerned, and you're going to go run a marathon. Like there's a natural progression of physiological adaptation, and it's stepwise. But, you know, I also hesitate to be like, just, you know, keep stretching your calves gently until your heels come down. It's like, no, it doesn't take that. It requires you walking 5 miles in a shoe without a heel now so that your heel drop down to the floor underneath your, you know, somewhere between 100 and 250 pounds. Like, those are loads, right? Those are many loads distributed throughout the day. And then you're not going to use your furniture as much. You're going to squat down too and come back up off the ground. So the muscular adaptation, which is then part of the constant signaling to the Achilles tendon, you know, all of that is happening as well. And maybe you do some high impacts, like maybe you're running a little bit and those are loads. And maybe you are also doing a little bit of like fascial mobilizing work at the same time. That adaptation is to all that you do, not necessarily to the one thing that you are consciously doing to facilitate change. And if you want to have your heels come down to the ground, you have to look at everything you do as an input to the calf muscle, not just the exercises and when you're thinking about your calves. Your calves and your Achilles tendon are responding to 100% of the input that you are selecting. And I don't think that people think about mechanical input outside of their exercise bout. And that, I think, is the problem. Like, we're trying to solve the problem, our skeletal problem or physical structural problems, in the realm of what can I maximize during this hour, instead of recognizing that the physical outcome you are experiencing is based on 24 hours a day of input. And so the amount of dollars and time and blog posts and videos dedicated to what you do 1 hour of the day and not to what you do 24 hours of the day, I think, is the first place to start. Like, before you think about what exercises, is like, well, what are your calves doing the other 23 hours of the day? And can you play with that? Because there's much greater surface area there,
right,
I guess, if you will.
Right, right. No, I love it. I love it. Love it. Let's shift gears a little bit to lymphatic flow. Cindy asks, She says, if this is two questions, please choose one, but I think they're related. So Cindy is sneaking in two questions here. please elaborate on pressure systems within the body and how they are changed slash improved by movement and how those changes in pressure can improve lymphatic flow throughout the body. And maybe even before that, why do we need lymph to flow at all? What's lymph doing?
Yeah, what's lymph? Well, like you have a lymphatic system that is part of your immune system, you know, integral part of your immune system. And that, I guess the easiest way to talk about it is just like, it's like the difference between running water and stagnant water. It's filtering, it's clearing off the waste that happens as you're created by your living, like your exhaust, if you will. So you want it moving. I mean, and it's running right alongside your vascular system. So you've got, you know, you've got your gas exchange that's happening between from your arteries to your veins, and the lymphatics are there, and all of that should be flowing along. You know, the blood is flowing along, and the lymphatics should be flowing along. And again, they're organically related because the lymphatics have your arterial system, your vascular system, your cardiovascular system has a pump. You have your heart as a pump, clearly, but your vascular system, it has its own, it can move itself. Like it has its own small pumping mechanism, but it depends heavily on the musculoskeletal system to drive its motion. So it doesn't have its own pump. Like if you lay down and stopped moving, you couldn't do that for very long, but your heart could at least keep your blood flowing. Well, with lymphatics, it doesn't have that super solid pump. Its function is directly tied up into the movements that you're doing. So that's lymphatics. And so I know who Cindy is, and I know kind of the question that she's asking. So I talk a lot about I believe she's asking because did you see the new discovery of the nervous system's lymphatic system, right? So that's going to be interesting because there are in general four that you can measure pressure within an enclosed system. So you have pelvic pressure. You've got intra-abdominal pressure, you've got thoracic or intrathoracic pressure, and you also have intracranial pressure. So when they put a pressure device in any of those areas, there is pressure there. And that pressure changes based on, like all pressures, based on the amount of stuff. So I explain pressure in terms of a room. You got a room and it's full of kids. The more kids in that small room, the higher the pressure. You can decrease the pressure by making the room really big. Or you could also decrease the pressure by taking some kids out of the room. So there is a relationship in terms of pressure, the size of the container, and how much stuff is in the container.
P1V1 equals P2V2.
Nice. Nice.
Just to go complete geek fest, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, it's so funny because I remember learning the quadratic formula to a song, and I'll never forget it. But I feel like what you just did was is that the way you memorized it, saying it like that?
To some degree, yeah. But
It was like a little R2-D2. It was like just like R2-D2-D2-D2. It had like a beat to it. Anyway, I really feel compelled to sing my quadratic formula.
Do it.
All right, you ready?
Yep.
X equals the opposite of B plus or minus the square root of B squared minus 4AC. And yo, don't forget, it's all over 2A.
Nice.
Yeah, that's for Miss Mutafian. Nice. In 10th grade. That one was for you, Mrs. Mutafian. All right. So anyway, where were we? We're pressure chambers. Okay, so pressure, you are a single structure with really, but you are made of lots of smaller compartments, but those compartments have soft walls. So we think of like the diaphragm as being a barrier between your abdomen and your thorax, but it's a fluid barrier, right? It can move, it can come up, it can go down. And so the activity of the diaphragm can change the pressure in the thoracic and in the abdominal cavity, that those pressures are always in a relationship. All of your pressures are in a relationship. And then you can also tense your abdominal muscles. And if your diaphragm doesn't change, that will increase your intra-abdominal pressure. You could also tense your abdominal muscles, but then move your diaphragm, in which case you wouldn't tense your abdomen. You wouldn't increase your intra-abdominal pressure, but you would increase the pressure of the room upstairs, right? The thoracic one. So you're constantly affecting your pressure by what muscles you're contracting, the sum total of all the muscles that you're contracting. So we think of them, then we think of like, but there are tubes of things flowing through these pressure chambers. So I was thinking about this and going, okay, so you've got, let's say you have a straw and you're trying to suck a smoothie up through a straw, but then someone comes around and puts a fist around your straw. So like the smoothie and the straw is like your lymphatic system. The straw and what's in it are the lymphatics and the gunk that's trying to move onto the lymph node to be processed. So now you have a hand around it. You've structurally squeezed it. But let's say that I don't have a hand directly around the straw. Let's say I have a balloon and I put the balloon around the straw, and then I put my hands around the balloon, around the straw. So my hands in this case are my abdominal muscles. The balloon that's wrapped around the straw is your abdominal viscera or your guts. And then you've got this tube going through. So when I squeeze everything, my muscles push on my guts, but then my guts are pushing on the tubes, and those tubes are going to push the stuff that's inside the straw up or down, depending on the sum total of pressure. So in that way, lymphatics and all flow are influenced by the environment of the body that they are flowing through. And that movement, when I'm talking about movement affecting flow, it's not only the movements of like your pumping arms and your pumping legs when you're walking around. It's also the tensions that you keep. That tension, that muscle contraction, you suck your stomach in all the time, or you want to keep your TVA activated all the time because you believe that in order to support your unmoving spine all of the time, you have to keep your TVA on all the time. Like, you end up changing the pressure systems, and that those pressure systems influence flow through the tubes, through all of your smooth muscles. So like, it affects even digestion. So that's why we talk, like, people who have a hard time digesting their food, I have them check, first of all, before we get to diet, which I don't do, would be like, well, you've been sucking your stomach in for the last 40 years. And so you, in fact, are down at the bottom of your smoothie straw, clenching it, and you're physically preventing the motion of food through your intestines. You're altering that mechanical environment because of what you're doing with your muscles. So muscle tension and flow go hand in hand, because pressure is like a structure, right? Pressure is like a fist. It can push on it. Even though it's invisible, it's still pushing, and pushing on fluids moves fluids around. So that's my final answer.
No, I like it. I was off thinking jujitsu thoughts about, because pressure, balance, timing, all that stuff is a big deal in the flow of jujitsu. So it's kind of fractal and stuff. So
yeah.
Okay. Now we're down to two listeners from the six that usually follow the show. Now that we've gone completely geek fest, let's pull some folks back in and talk about some squat mechanics. Joe says, I can squat with parallel feet just fine, which I do as per the recommendations of Kelly Starrett. Adding weight, however, I end up on the outside edges of my feet. My toes really want to be pointed out. Should I squat with pointed toes, or will this exacerbate my lack of mobility? I have some thoughts on this one, too.
Well, I mean, I think that the question is I would add the answer that I would go for is, you need to be working on mobility exercises so that you can carry more weight in the position that you want. So either the weight that you're adding to your squat is too much, or it was too big of a leap, right? So when you turn your feet straight, you could be doing that turn in at the shin level. You could be just rotating in the lower leg, bringing the foot around, or some people just try to turn their foot in at the ankle, in which case it's not really a turn in as much as it's a weird twisting or bending of the foot. So the answer would be, or what my encouragement would be you need to start working on the mobility of the foot and your lower legs as a separate set of exercises. Then you could look at where you can squat and then start adding small amounts of weight and see at what point you have exceeded the amount of letting your feet participate in your workout, right? So it's kind of like, it's a way of throwing the lower leg under the bus. It's like my lower leg, my knee cannot bear the load that I'm trying to carry in this position. So I'm going to move my lower leg out. So you're effectively strengthening the turnout of your lower leg, eventually setting up where you've got a permanent structural adaptation where your lower leg rotates away from your upper leg, meaning that since that's the highest intensity thing that you're doing in terms of force generation. So when you adapt a structure, you don't only adapt to static positioning, you adapt to really high loads. You know, the loads that you create in different positions matter when it comes to structural or mass distribution. So if you really want to squat heavy with your feet pointing straight ahead, where you're using your foot and your ankle and your lower leg and your knee and your upper leg and your hip together, then you would want to drop your weight way down and slowly start adding to see at what point is my weight exceeding the participation ability of my lower leg, and start there. And then that way you can close that physiological gap over time. You're going to facilitate it with some corrective exercise, but you can also go for the heavy loading. But it's like, why shouldn't your heavy loading also involve your lower leg? If you do that enough, train for heavy with this kind of malformed lower shin, then you'll never be able to have this kind of upright structure when you're not heavy lifting, which is going to be most of the time. Final answer.
No, I like it. And you know, some of this recommendation, or I guess the whole recommendation, really stems from that parallel foot position being representative of maximum torque, maximum force generation with kicking, running, jumping, change of direction and whatnot. And so I guess to your point, why not strengthen in that kind of advantageous athletic position versus reinforcing something that's going to force a toe out position, which really isn't as advantageous for these other athletic, broader movement categories.
Yeah, and then also, you know, I'm almost never approaching it from an athletic perspective. I'm approaching it as like a knee integrity longevity thing. So if your goal is, it's a two separate goals. I'm looking at what are the things that you want your knees to be able to do. I mean, it's really thinking outside of doing the exercise now and being able to do the exercise in the future. It's more about what is the function and the flow and the cellular loads to the leg as a whole. Like, what about the nerves that come through the hips, like to the feet? And how are those, like how are things that are totally unrelated to exercise, diseases that seem totally unrelated to exercise, not just things like I tore my ACL, you know, lifting this really heavy thing or whatever, like actual neurological functions and neuropathy and, you know, I can go on and on. How are those affected by what you're doing? So what I see, you know, with this person, and it's a place where we're all at, you know, it's what I see is this person going, I can keep good form with no weight, but I lose good form with heavy weight. And so it's the same thing. It's like, I can breathe just fine sitting on the couch, but I come out of breath when I try to run 20 miles. It's like, well, then why don't you start walking first?
Right.
And then why don't you start walking, jogging combo? And then why don't you, you know, like, it's just, again, it's about a physiological guideline. It should occur, I think, to every trainer or exercise out there that you're just lifting too heavy for that form that you want. And so just see what happens. Like, it'd be really cool to, you know, train this person to not be able to lift as heavy as possible where that was the variable, but how heavy can you lift within a particular form? Because that would be, that's a whole different variable. And then, you know, he can play with that. He can still go back to his other one, but if he's only doing that, you are strengthening the turnout. It's not a turnout of the foot. It's a rotation of the lower leg away from the upper leg. Mm-hmm. It's actual shank rotation. So if you think of your vessels going through from your hip to your feet as tubes, you've now twisted the tubes. The tubes have a rotation in them. Rotation of the tubes are fine. Rotation of the tubes, almost every minute of your life, not fine. So it's, again, it's thinking about different, like a lot of the form arguments, form like in lifting form or form for exercise alignment or whatever, always kind of stems down to like this idea that this posture is bad, this posture is good, but all movements that you can do are good. It's about the frequency and the adaptation to a particular frequency. So what happens when you introduce bends or rotations into tubes, and then start to see the adaptations to those rotations, you know, that is potentially disease making, right? Because it's loads on the cellular level, like loads and through the blood vessels, and that's in the cardiovascular section and move your DNA. Like what happens when you introduce bends in your blood, in your arteries that aren't supposed to be there or shouldn't be there with great frequency? The bend is fine. It's just that when you put a bend in a blood vessel, right, and you're rolling balls down a hallway, blood vessels, blood flowing, rolling balls down a hallway, and all of a sudden you bend that hallway, and you're still rolling balls down, and you end up getting a trauma on the wall. But if that bend is only temporary for like 7 or 8 things or 7 or 8 minutes or even 25 things that you do that day, but it goes away, then that wound has a chance to heal. But it's these bends that sit here indefinitely, you know, that can induce genetic changes to the lining of your artery. So that's what I'm most concerned about for, what's this guy's name?
That
Joseph.
Was Joseph.
Yeah. Joseph. That'd be, yeah. I was like, Joseph, you could lift heavy with your feet pointing forward if you just had a more detailed exercise program.
More progressive approach.
Yeah.
I like it. I like it. Okay, let's talk mechanotransduction. Raphael says, hey, Rob and Katie, please expand upon the mechanotransduction and specifically how it relates to health issues, which may not necessarily be associated with movement issues and injuries. For example, how would inappropriate tissue compression or sedentism induce changes in a cell, which can be characterized as a disease phenotype? And I think you talked about this a bit already, but maybe we'll... In talking with lymphatics, it seems like you talked a bit about this.
Yeah, and that's one. I mean, that's like a non-exercise one. But I think what Raphael and as is, you know, you're a bit cells in your arteries going from arteroprotective to arterogenetic, where you're actually inducing an epigenetic change where a tissue which was not before, which was resisting plaque, is now accumulating plaque because of the loads that you're applying to it. Like that's not necessarily associated with exercise. But I mean, even like with things like cancer, he might be talking about things like cancer, but I think in general with mechanotransduction, so mechanotransduction, just for anyone who's just listening for the first time, is the process by which cells sense and translate mechanical signals into biochemical signals. And then the cells can adjust their structure and their function based on that input. So it's not really well known. So like this is kind of all brand new, but in general, and so this is what I'm working on. This is what I'm working on right now, a couple different papers. And movement as a whole, I'll just call it exercise because what people are looking at is exercise for the most part. What researchers are looking at is exercise. Exercise is believed to be protective of disease in two different ways, or it might be they're working together. It's not quite clear. But exercise can affect the mitochondria, or like the number of mitochondria, or the effectiveness of mitochondria, or it's influencing the genetic expression. So that's how it's kind of understood right now. But my contribution, so I'm not a geneticist, I'm not a cellular biologist, I'm a biomechanist. So my contribution really to this discussion has to do with right now, when we think of exercise and the benefits of exercise, we assume, the literature assumes that the benefit of exercise is global. So when you exercise, there is a global improvement to the mitochondria or to this influence in genetic expression for like a healthier phenotype in general, like a healthier phenotype. But it's a mechanotransduction and things like genetic influence or mitochondria, the effect on mitochondria is measured cellularly. It's measured regionally, locally. They just pull out a cell. And so my contribution is that is helping people understand how when they are moving, I'm going to go out for a run, I'm going to go do a workout, the way that we see the benefits of exercise are global in that I've improved because the variables of measuring it are global. Like I've measured my blood serum levels of X, Y, and Z. My heart rate was this, my blood pressure is this. They're whole system evaluations. Yet there are these pockets of disease that are arising in people who are still exercising. So then the contribution is you are not moving, all of you. You are moving not only too little as an entire structure, that there are parts of you that aren't moving at all, even when the whole entire structure of you is going for a workout. And so we've been on this path for a while with this idea of going, even if you're really fit in this way, you probably need to cross train a little bit, because when you get really fit in this way, there are these kind of cellular breakdowns that then lead to a musculoskeletal injury. So let's vary it up a little bit so that you're strengthening more of your parts. Like we always talk about it in whole parts, like you're like the front of your thigh is stronger than the back of your thigh. So do some exercises for the back of your thigh, where I'm usually talking about movement on a cellular level, where there are these pockets of cells that are doing really well and then these pockets of cells that are not. But it's still related back to that a lot of your muscles aren't moving, that we can get by doing something whole body, but still using very little of our body to do it. And I'm starting to, like, there's a lot more trend towards this idea of elastic. You know, it's like, well, you use this motion, you can do this exercise by calling on your connective tissue to launch you in it, because there's no energy cost. You don't have to muscularly contract to let, you know, your Achilles tendon recoil when you're running, right? That's elastic. But the benefits of exercise come from the muscular contraction part. So we have this kind of idea of, you know, because we've isolated performance and we're thinking about conservation of energy, the body is trying to conserve energy. So it's natural to move towards elastic, but the reason we are moving so greatly towards elastic types of movement is because we are sedentary. We are totally sedentary people. The people who are not sedentary differ only from the sedentary population by 60 to 120 minutes of a day. Hmm. And so everyone is sedentary. Everyone listening to this is sedentary, unless you're not. But for the most part, there are two new categories of people in research, sedentary and active sedentary. There are not populations who are actually moving many, many minutes throughout the day, throughout a lifetime. And for the populations that are moving a lot, like I'm thinking of like people who are like doing manual labor, their ranges of movement are very, very small. The degrees of motion of their joints are very small, even though the minutes of movement would be very high. Because we are talking about a biochemical response to a particular mechanical deformation, the degrees at which your joints are articulating affect which muscles are contracting and secreting these myokines, and that without this wide variance of degrees of use of all of your, the number of muscles throughout your body, many, many minutes a day, we are not seeing the full expression, if you will, of the protective benefit of exercise. It's in these tiny pockets. So my contribution is that you cannot apply the fact that you exercise your whole body because of what your heart rate did or whatever to the entire body. If you're going to evaluate the local benefit, whether it's a change in the genetic expression or the concentration of myokines or the number of mitochondria that came about because of this exercise, you have to also start talking about movement as a cellular phenomenon regionally, as opposed to what your whole body did. Because that's, I think, where, I think that's the piece that is not integrated yet. It's like, hey, I went out for a run. And it's like, yeah, but most of you did nothing for that run. And that the shuttling around of your blood and the response, the adaptation is only to those few parts that were working. And that and the parts that are working are getting lesser, fewer in number. Mm-hmm. I think is the right English there. I don't know if it's lesser or fewer. I think it's fewer when it's countable.
Right.
Are becoming fewer in number because you're adapting, like your structure is still looking like it's wearing, you know, high heels and a chair when you get out. And so you just kind of keep snapping back to this position and you're using the snapback to facilitate your movement and not muscle contraction. So the active sedentary population fares much better than the sedentary. But the hypothesis is not nearly to someone who is actually moving all of themselves all of the time.
So interesting, and quite an additional wrinkle to all that, because I mean it's hard enough to like I mentioned earlier, you know, within this kind of hyper specialized world, if you do have a situation where you can do some pretty active work as part of your day, it does end up boiling, you know, like we're out on a 2.5-3 acre farm now, and I do some shoveling and picking and hoeing and raking and all that. And I noticed that it does still drop into a pretty small frequency distribution of what I'm doing. And I end up trying to be as efficient as possible on that process. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, again, it's habitat, you know, like farm is not a natural habitat. Like it's, you're moving towards it, but it's still like all of your stuff is still within, you know, 3 acres of you, like the bulk of the time, as opposed to really needing to move to get what you needed. Like there's just the, I tried to follow my kids around and doing all the movements that they did in one day. And I was like, holy crap, I'm exhausted.
Right.
Now imagine following a population of people who actually had to move. Like my kids are moving because it's innate. Like there's this, at least there seems to be this innate, like I want to move all the time. Ah. But when you follow other, like if you were following a nomadic hunter-gathering population that's on the planet right now, I think the amount of movement would be exhausting. Like it just, I mean, people where I tried to stand all day at this, you know, at the Paleo FX conference and my legs are tired. And it's like, we are tired. Our legs are like not even strong enough to hold us, like stand, not using a chair at a conference, which is, you know, 6 or 7 hours.
Right.
How would you actually fare out really trying to do not these isolated feats, right? Like you could, people have trained themselves like I could totally run 7 or 10 miles fast, you know, it's like, great. But could you then walk, you know, 11 more miles because, you know, and then could you go carry your kids, have to get somewhere? Like, and what about the older people? Like there's just, it's just so, it's so much, the discrepancy is so huge. I don't even think we can put it in our minds yet about a level of movement, the variance, the number, not just the number of minutes, but the variance and of all the things that you would have to do.
Right, right. No, it's funny because, you know, I lift some weights, do some gymnastics, compete in some old guy Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And when I throw Zoe in a backpack to go for a little stomp around the neighborhood, my foot muscles get incredibly fatigued and very, very quickly. And even if I do a walk without Zoe, if I'm pulling some pretty good hills and trying to keep a pretty good clip, my foot muscles, like I'm kind of like, oh, I can motor through this, but they are clearly fatigued, clearly not up to snuff. And I mean, I'm just walking.
I know.
And I am inadequately prepared to go for a 2 to 4 mile walk around my neighborhood.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's the just walking. Like, we just have this idea that the only parameter by which to evaluate exercise is intensity. So, or heart rate. And so if my intensity or heart rate is low, it must just, like, you are still using many, many muscles and many different joint configurations. And that's what you're adapting to, is all of that. You know, you're adapting to that just as much as you're adapting to intensity and heart rate. And
right. It's funny, right before I jumped on the call with you, I was reading a piece on conditioning for MMA athletes. And, you know, I was going to skip this one question because we're kind of running. Are you okay for a couple more minutes?
Yeah, I'm fine.
So, this guy, Joel Jameson, phenomenal MMA coach, really has had huge success in building the gas tank on a lot of his fighters. But to facilitate that, there is this need for, he has his folks wear heart rate monitors and heart rate variability monitors and for different training adaptations of the cardiovascular response and parasympathetic versus sympathetic response. You need to keep the heart rate within these really tight parameters, which things like aerodynes and stair steppers and VersaClimbers really lend themselves well to that, because you can meter out a very prescribed dose. It's like an IV drip. You know, it's like, okay, I need to be between 130 and 135 beats per minute. I can totally wire that in on this contraption. When I get out around my house, and particularly around Reno, everything in our neighborhood is either up or down. For trying to do conditioning to improve specifically my jiu-jitsu, it's very, very hard to get that type of stimulus from being out and getting that mixed movement palette. But yet the things that I can do to get the adaptation that theoretically will help the engine for my jiu-jitsu ends up being a very limited movement palette. And from an orthopedics and kind of long-term aging perspective, is probably not that good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, it's another way of I want to say specify. It's not like it's a specialization, right? Your specialization, your body is specialized for jiu-jitsu, and all of our bodies, and you're trying to train yourself that way. And we are all specialized to doing exactly what it is that we have been doing. So, if you want to be, can we be, I think that we can expand this term. Like, when I think specialized, I think that we are already pretty well specialized as human beings, but what we're specialized for are having more humans. Like, to me, that's the biggest specialization. Is like, you're going to, and I'm not using the term, I think, in the way that other people would use the term, but what I'm really most, I don't want to say concerned with, what I'm most interested in is, you know, we're having a problem really with humans moving forward other humans without technological intervention. And so, you know, if we're losing our specialization to make more humans so that we can be specialized to living in our houses and sitting in our chairs, like, then to, like, that's the only question I'm working on, is like, what does that mean? What is that? What is that all about? You know, people they'll send me a picture of Wall-E. Here, watch Wall-E. Maybe we talked about Wall-E before. Yeah, they're like, look at these ridiculous people in their chairs floating around. It's like, well, they are specialized in their chairs, and we're just on the cusp. I got a question. It's like, why do I care if I can wiggle my toes? Like, who cares about minimal shoes? I have no need to wiggle my toes. I do not need to wiggle my toes. I have this structure that I can buy and put around my foot that protects my foot. And it's like, that's fine. But if the wiggling of the toes is part of the engine of the entire machine and you slowly lose it, then the people sitting in their Wally chairs could have the exact same argument. It's like, why do I need to lose my why do I need to use my legs? I have a chair that will get me from point A to point B. So it becomes quickly a slippery slope if we don't see the need for movement because of some convenience that can move for us. So in that way, it's like there's not really any difference. Like, why are the people in Wally so bad? You know, like if they don't need to move, if something's being given to them, like adaptation is for the benefit to adaptation depends on you continuing to live in the environment in which you are suited for. So the only reason to be concerned with not being able to use your legs or moving your toes is in the case that shoe or that motorized chair is not available. We at this time cannot foresee a time in which every technological advance, you know, which is powered by fossil fuels and, you know, labor of other people in different places and minerals from the ground that take quite a bit of human effort, mm-hmm. energy, but also like on the backs of other people who are suffering to get it. You know, it's like that is the environment to which we are adapted to. So we were in Iceland and we went to the Viking Museum, but it's equally horrific. And like, you know, they were talking about the people came over with their, you know, their very primitive star navigation skills, you know, and they didn't even have a compass, you know, the imbeciles. And like, it was very quaint, like how quaint this skill of navigating by the stars is, because we have compasses now, like we have actual GPS. And so like we were able to create this. And yes, a few people were able to create it, but the bulk of the people just know how to facilitate pushing the buttons on those things. So keeping that in mind, we were laughing about that, is like that it seemed like a primitive skill, where to me, navigating by the stars seems way harder than using my iPhone to figure out how to get somewhere.
Right.
So now there's a new plant identifying app that is like the one that, like a song. Do you remember like that song identifying app?
Oh, right.
You just put it on. So the same technology is being used for a plant identifying app. So you can be out and you can, is it edible? Is it poisonous? And you just take a picture of it. And don't go searching for it now. I think it only works in France. They're trying to get a more global plant database. But right now it's like French. And so if you're in France, I guess you could get it. But I was thinking, you know, so when we have this app, when everyone has this plant identification app, like, do we feel ourselves like more better able to survive than those people who used to just have to know this in their head, you know, who just knew it through hours of experience to be able to do it? Like, who is more skilled? The person who knows this, like embodies it, or the person who can operate the app to identify it for them? Like, how will we come to view? Like, will it be the same way of us looking back on these primitive skills? Like, we'd be like, these primitive people actually used to have to
rub sticks together for fire.
Clutter their brain. Yes, rub sticks together and clutter their brain with all this information when this information can just be put into this device. But should that device be no longer available, or there's no place to charge it, or there's no energy to charge it with, now you are back to being unsuitable for the environment and you're at, you know, a greater risk, right? So I always just think of the environment as dynamic, the habitat, the ecosystem. Like right now I look at how many other support things it takes for me to do human things, like eat and go to the bathroom and have a baby. And when I start seeing like huge amounts of technology being required to do the things that we were already specialized in because of our decision to be specialized in other things, that's interesting to me.
Oh, it's super interesting, and that's part of my sustainability, more important than abs. Like,
yeah.
And this freaks people out, and you know, it's pushing good food and movement is already kind of an uphill battle when you start talking about the you know, eventuality of oil being $300 a barrel and food, transportation, and all that stuff. It's a huge buzzkill for people, but I think it's worth putting a little bit of thought towards in your, you know, your day-to-day existence and planning and all that. Well, Katie, we're at about an hour and 20 minutes.
Holy cow.
I could seriously talk to you for like 6 hours a shot here. where can folks track you down on the interwebs?
You can find me at restorativeexercise.com, which links to my blog, katiesays.com, or our Facebook page is pretty popular, Twitter, Aligned and Well. Program is the handle for Twitter and Facebook. So you can come over and say hi.
Cool. Awesome. I frequently do, and I'm always fascinated by the things that you're talking about. You are still one of my favorite guests that we've ever had on here. I usually know a topic well enough that I can have some pithy follow-up questions and whatnot, but when you are talking, I am so focused on learning what you're talking about that my pithy rejoinders are not quite as pithy as usual. So, but that's good. It's a huge treat for me. Really appreciated having you on the show again. Let's do this in 4 or 6 months. Get you back on here if you're game for it.
Sure, always.
Awesome, Katie. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Bye-bye.